This today is November the 17th, 02, and Casey and I are going to record some of our memories for you children to listen to at some future point in time. But Candace has asked us to record something about our parents from before we were born to start this out, to introduce this. And the story I want to tell you is about my father. When my father was 8 years old, they lived in Arkansas in the Ozarks, in the mountainous place. And Kathleen says it was Oklahoma Territory, but Oklahoma Territory is where my father was born. He wasn't even born in the United States. But at any rate, they moved to the Ozarks, and in a mountainous area where their home was, my grandfather and my father's two older brothers were all three working in construction work, and so they weren't home. So my grandmother sent my father down to pick up the mail. Pick up the mail, he had to ride down the mountain pick to the mailbox that was on the road. So riding down there on his little pony, he got about halfway down, and a coyote jumped up and spooked the pony that he was riding. The pony bucked and threw my father off. Now, when he woke up several hours later, he has no idea how long, much longer later, surrounding him in a circle were wild hogs, boars with their long tusks, and his little dog was running in the circle from one side to the other, barking and keeping them away from my father. And my father always felt like that little dog saved his life, that the wild hogs would have destroyed him if he hadn't been there. Now, that's a memory of my parents. My parents were married when my mother was 18 and my father was 21. My father saw her at a county fair and thought she was the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen, and immediately started courting her, and they were married very shortly thereafter. Now, my earliest memory that I can recall is being stung by a bee. When I was 3 years old, we lived in Montana. My father and mother were both teaching at an Indian school. This was during the Depression, 1930, and jobs were very hard to find. They were delighted to get this job. My father had completed 2 years of college at Pittsburgh State Teachers College, and this was his first job. And they had let my mother, even though she had never gone to high school, attend the college to take sewing and cooking courses so that she could teach the girls. It was part of the deal, a package deal. Both of them had to teach. So when I was 3 years old, I was walking up the stairs, and it's strange that I can remember it very clearly, like it was yesterday. And I put my hand down on the stairs, and immediately a bee stung it. A bee stung it on one of my fingers, and it just hurt like crazy. And I remember starting to cry, I couldn't remember whether to go up the stairs and find my mother or go down the stairs and find my father in the classroom. I finally went down the stairs, and he picked me up and carried me upstairs to my mother, and they did something so it was hurting less. So that was my first memory. I vaguely remember the Indian children, the Indian that I played with all the time, from the age of 1 year to 4 years of age, and I learned the Cree language. At least enough of it to get by. the school had been built by the government for the Indian children, and some of the adults came to school also. I can vaguely remember. They were very friendly, warm, wonderful people, but when I was 3 years old, I had a little lamb that was a pet that they had given me, and we left for the summer because school didn't happen in the summer. All the children were absolutely needed to work the fields. So when we came back in the fall, we said, "Where's Billy? Where's Billy's little lamb?" And they said, "Oh, we don't know. I guess it just wandered off someplace." And later, much later, my parents told me that they ate my little pet lamb. Well, that's enough of my stories. Now Casey's going to tell some stories about her early life, too. One other story that Kathleen and Candace want me to tell was when I was circumcised. I was 3 years old. I wasn't circumcised at birth for some reason, probably because I was born in the home and not in the hospital. At any rate, because of the foreskin, my penis was irritated all the time, and I was constantly scratching it. And so they took me to the doctor, and I had trouble holding my urine, even though I was 3 years old. So they took me to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, he's got to be circumcised." So the closest hospital or medical center was in Havre, Montana. So I was taken there and put to sleep and circumcised. When I woke up, my penis just hurt like crazy, and I had the feeling that I remember the feeling still of shame and of thinking that it was hurting so bad because I was constantly touching it and rubbing it because it was irritated, and that that I was being punished in some way. But my folks explained it to me, and eventually I did get over that. I think.
Didn't you also have the tonsillectomy at the same time?
No, I had my tonsils removed when I was 6 years old, and by that time we were back in near Neosho, Missouri. And that was a very painful episode in my life also, but by that age I was able to understand it a lot better.
My Aunt Josephine told me that when my father was about 17 years old, he was working for the Santa Fe Railroad, and he had been put out of his home when he was 11, and he worked in the farms kind of not too far away from where his mother was in Wakefield, Kansas. But as he got to be older, he was able to get a job with the railroad, and the railroad was working its way across Kansas down into Oklahoma. And when, by the time he was 17, he was in Oklahoma, quite a bit south of the Kansas border, and he became sick. There were several people along with him. Well, one of his best buddies also became sick, and the railway doctors examined him and said, "Well, he has typhoid. He can't work anymore, and so that's it. He's fired."
Before that, he'd been shot by an Indian.
Well, yes, I should tell you about his. While he was down there, before he got so sick, he went to town one Saturday night with his buddies, and they all, of course, they went to the saloon to get drunk and so on. But my father did not. My father was terrified of alcohol because his father was an alcoholic and drank something fierce. And my father, he always was, well, he would... Mr. Jones was brutal to my dad when he was drunk, and my dad just, he never wanted anything to do with alcohol. But he wanted to go to town with the fellas, and so they did go to town, and he was standing out by the horses where the horses were drinking. There was a horse tank on the street in front of the saloon. The horses were tied up there. And he was standing there looking at the horses and talking to his buddies when a drunken Indian came out of the saloon and started shooting wildly in all directions. And he shot my father in the arm. And my father, of course, dipped down below the horses and sort of hid under the horses. And it was a flesh wound. But he had that scar as long as he lived. And he was always fond of showing me that scar, telling me that a drunken Indian shot him there. He got over that flesh wound very quickly. But when he got sick with typhoid fever, there was no getting over that. And he and his best buddies were so deathly sick. And he told the fella who was the manager or the gang boss, whatever, that if he could just get a ride back up into Kansas with the train, that he'd get off in Abbeville, at the Abbeville stop, and he could get to his grandfather, and would the Santa Fe Railway let him ride that far? And said, sure, they could do that. So he and his buddy got in one of the stock cars and rode up there in the hay up to Abbeville. Well, if you've ever looked at the map of Kansas and you look at Abbeville, it's a little town, I believe just a little bit south of Hutchinson, and it's just a little crossroads place. And my father'd never been there, but he had heard his mother say that her father lived there in Abbeville. So he and his buddy got on the train and took it as far as Abbeville, and then they got off there. And when they got off, they both were so sick that they hardly knew where they were, and they started walking. And I don't think my father was carrying a bag or carrying anything. I think he and the boy, his buddy, were just walking along themselves, and they asked somebody where John Martin lived. Well, whoever they asked thought that my father and his buddy were drunk, and so they were in a horse and carriage, and as they went by the Martin farm, they went in to see my grandfather Martin, and they said, there's a couple of boys down the road that were asking about you, asking where you lived. And they looked like a couple of drunks to me. Well, my grandfather got in his little buckboard with a horse attached to it and went down there and to see who those boys were. And when he got down there, the boys were both lying in the ditch. They weren't able to walk any farther. And so he tried to talk to them, but they were unconscious. So he got both of them, he picked them both up and put them in the back of that little buckboard and took them back to the farm and went in and told my Aunt Josephine that these are the boys he picked up that were on the road looking for him. And he thought that they ought to get their clothes off of them and wash them down and put them in some fresh hay and take care of them until they came to, because I think they knew that my father and the boy had typhoid fever. Typhoid was so common in those days, and frequently people walked the roads and had it and had no place to go. There were no hospitals. There were no places where you could go for respite. And if you were lucky, as my father was, somebody would take you in. So my Aunt Josephine laid my dad and his buddy on the floor of the barn and took their scissors and cut their clothes off of them, because of course they were covered with vomit and defecation. They were, I'm sure, just sickening to smell and touch. And my Aunt Josephine took all their clothes off and washed them down, and then she dried them both off and put her nightgowns on both of them and carried them, picked them up and carried them in the house and put them in the bed, in the bedroom that was right beside the kitchen. Everybody used to have a bedroom right beside the kitchen so sick folks could be taken care of.
Birthing
and dying room. And so she would go in there 3 or 4 times a day, of course, to offer them water and try to get them to eat a little soup. But they didn't eat, and they drank water, but they didn't eat anything for 3 or 4 days. She was really worried about them. And finally she went in, every time she went in, she would ask both of them, "What is your name?" And they never could tell her. But one day, my father said, "My name is Ira Jones, and I'm looking for my grandfather, John Martin." She was so thrilled. She jumped up and ran in and told my grandfather that it was Ira Jones, and it was Fanny's boy. And, of course, John Martin certainly remembered his daughter, Fanny. And so they knew who he was. They didn't know who the boy was for quite a while longer, because he couldn't seem to tell his name. And nobody ever told me the boy's name. I have no idea who he was. But at any rate, the two boys, little by little, got better. And then eventually, of course, my father knew where he was and knew that he had arrived at the right spot, and all of his travelings were ended happily. So that's how my father got hooked up with his grandfather. And that was a wonderful thing for my dad, because he stayed there on that farm and worked for 3 or 4 more years. And my grandfather helped him go to Nickerson Normal College, where he finished his schooling. That's all the schooling he had, just up to the 4th or 5th grade there in Wakefield. And then he went to Nickerson Normal for 2 or 3 years, and then he went to Western Dental College, which now is part of the University of Missouri's medical school system, and that was in Kansas City.
Yes.
So that's a story about my... Oh, my father had such tales about when he went to dental college. He worked as an usher in one of the theaters in Kansas City, saw all the plays, and saw lots and lots of vaudeville. And also he worked as a roofer. What they roofed with was slate. They were slate. He worked for a fellow that laid slate roofing on houses. And, oh, he thought my father was wonderful, and always told him, "Now, you've got a real talent for laying slate roofing. You know, that's what you ought to do with your life, is be a roofer." My father used to say, maybe that's what I should have done. Stuck to slate roofing. Of course, nobody uses slate roofing, and they haven't for the last 50 years. But at any rate, that's the story of my dad. I want to tell you that my great-grandfather, John Martin, he came to this country when he was about the same age as my dad was when my dad got typhoid fever. He was, 17 along there. And my grandfather had married a girl in Illinois. He was terribly young when he married her, and she was pretty young too. And he was drafted just almost immediately into the Army. And this was the Union Army, of course, out of Illinois. And he went off to war, and while he was gone and at the war, while he was gone to the Civil War, the word was that he had been killed in action. And 6 or 7 months after that, his wife, whatever his wife's name was, fell in love with her next door neighbor and promised to marry him. And so when my great-grandfather came back from the Civil War, he thought he was coming back to his, you know, to his wife, but she told him, "Now, I've promised to marry somebody else because we thought you were dead." Well, he was furious, but he said, "Well, I don't want to keep you from anything big, so you can go ahead and marry him as far as I'm concerned." But she had a little baby, and it was his baby, and the baby's name was Fanny, and she kept that little baby, and so he always knew that Fanny was his baby, and she was raised there in Illinois, and eventually she fell in love with a man named J.J. L. Jones. Fanny did. Fanny fell in love with this man named J.J. L. Jones. And that man was my grandfather. It was my dad's father. And so now you know who all the characters are that are in that little story that I just told you. Fanny was my father's mother. J.J. L. Jones was his father. He was the one that drank so much. And he was a newspaper man. And he was a newspaper man until the day he died. He went back when he was 40, 45, something like that, back to Pennsylvania to a little town called Forest City. And he went back to work for a newspaper there in that town. His father, J.J. L. Jones's father, was named Richard Jones. Richard Lewis, I believe, was his name. And his wife's name was Anna. Do you remember her name? Well, anyway, they're buried there in Forest City, Pennsylvania, and so is J.J. L. He's buried in the same lot with Richard and Anna, whatever her name was. And he left Fanny in Wakefield. Oh, and that Richard was an interesting man. He was the last Welsh preacher, Presbyterian preacher, in the United States. He had a church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where he preached every Sunday in Welsh. And, of course, you know, there was a great movement during the 19th century to stomp out all those foreign language groups and get everybody to speaking English. And so when he retired, that was the end of the Welsh-speaking church.
Now I want to tell you about my grandfather, who I called Daddy Pop. Everybody called him Daddy Pop. He was my father's father, and when I was born, I was born in his home. And he just loved me as a little baby. When I'd cry at night, he'd get up and fix me a bottle and give me a bottle. He'd always got up early in the morning, and when I'd cry, then he'd come pick me up and let my mother and father sleep in the morning. And a strange thing he told me about, that he always fried a piece of bacon, and then he and I shared a piece of bacon. I was just a very tiny baby, but I didn't. Apparently, I never choked on it, and just really was satisfied with it, liked it. Later on, when I was 5 years old, he taught me how to read. He taught me my ABCs and how to count and spent time with me so that when I was six, school started a week after my sixth birthday. I could start, they started me in the second grade. But this was a one-room country school where they only taught the grades every other year. In other words, the year I started, they were teaching the second, fourth, sixth, and eighth grades. And it was a wonderful experience being in a one-room country school, which I was for the first 12 years of my life in various small country schools where my father was a school teacher, because one of the children that was in the grade ahead of you, like when I was in the second grade or fourth grader, spent about half the day with me, helped tutoring me, teaching me, and in a very warm, friendly way. It was just expected of everybody to do that, and they enjoyed it. They liked it. Daddy Pop was a contractor. He built houses. One day in 1929, in the fall of 1929, he had 14 houses either under construction or completed. The next day, the bank had foreclosed on all of them except one. He only got to keep one house that he lived in. This was during the Depression, when the banks were failing and were closing, taking money, and the banks were very rigid about this. The way he did this was, as soon as he started a new house, they loaned him the money for the entire value of the house to build it. And so, but the loans were written in such a way so that they could foreclose at any time. So that ended his contracting career. He never recovered from that. The next year, after I was in the second grade in this one-room school, I was in the third grade. My father could not get a job. This was in the depths of the Depression. This would have been 1933. And he could not find a school teaching job. So we lived on a fruit farm where my grandfather had taken in trade for a house. On this fruit farm, there were apple orchards and grape vineyards. And in between the rows and the grape vineyards were the dewberries that were, and all three of those crops were picked by pickers that would come out, and of course me too. And I got paid, I think, 2 cents a box for picking grapes and raspberries, and the box was a 1-quart size box. So, you know, I made money. Had a paper route. I sold a weekly publication called Grit for 5 cents, and I got to keep 2 cents of that 5 cents. And out in the country, I would walk a mile or more in between each effort to sell that paper, so I probably wore out more shoes than I made in selling the papers. But at any rate, I felt like I had money of my own. And on Saturday, we would go into town, and frequently Daddy Pop took me into town. And I remember we could buy ice cream cones, 2 for a nickel. And we could buy Mexican tamales for 10 cents. And, but at any rate, I was in the third grade. And I had to walk several miles to get to school. I don't want to exaggerate here. Maybe it was 2 miles to get to school. And in school, for some reason or other, I was just picked on, bullied by the kids. And this culminated in my taking a watch to school that I'd been given my birthday just before school started. And somebody held me down and took my watch away from me. At that point, my father decided that I didn't have to go to that school anymore. I could stay home, and he and my mother would teach me. At that time, my father couldn't find work, so he got a job with the WPA. My Uncle Joe was a foreman with the WPA, and this was the Works Project Administration, a President Roosevelt make work during the height of the Depression. And what they were doing were building bridges, making modern bridges out of old country roads. And my father worked polishing concrete with a brick. That's what he did. And he came down with terrible back trouble. He went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, "You have to eat grapefruit. Grapefruit will make your back heal well." And I suppose that had a little bit of validity. The vitamin C maybe helped a little bit. But I remember that we had very little money, and I remember how delicious that grapefruit looked that my father got to eat, and my mother and I didn't get to eat it.
I remember Mr. Howland hated it terribly that he ate that grapefruit in front of you and Grace, and he felt so bad about it, but he was so anxious to get well and for his back to get strong. He unloaded a whole freight car full of concrete, didn't he? What, 50-pound sacks?
100-pound sacks.
100-pound sacks.
Two at a time.
Two at a time. Oh, my God.
And that's when his back started really bothering him.
Well, I should think so. That's more than a horse could pull. I asked him one time, how could you get a WPA job when you're a rank Republican? How did that work out? Well, he said, I told the WPA that I was a Democrat, and they gave me a marked ballot when I went in to vote. And naturally, I picked up a ballot myself and marked a straight Republican ticket, put it in, and threw away the ballot that they gave me. So when I came out, they said, where's your ballot? And he said, why, I marked it just like you told me to. And I put it in the ballot box. Well, he said, you were supposed to bring it out, stupid.
Bring back the blank.
Yes, bring back the blank one so we could mark it for the next fella. Well, Pop said, I didn't understand that. He said, I understood it perfectly, but I knew it was as crooked as could be. But that's how the whole thing worked then. But Margaret was a sister of William Gillespie, that is my grandfather, Angie's dad. And her husband made the arrangements for Mary Jane Gillespie and her baby William to come by covered wagon to Kansas. But she and her husband had come a year earlier, and so they sort of knew how it all went, knew what the ropes were and what the expenses were and so forth. So she wrote to Molly, Virginia, and told her how much money she'd have to have. Well, Mary Jane Gillespie sold, I'm sorry, I said Molly, Virginia, Mary Jane Gillespie was William's mother, and she sold everything on the plantation that she could to get money to go to Kansas. And of course, everything she sold it to the Southerners, and they gave her Confederate money. And she had so much Confederate money, she had it stuffed in stockings. My mother said she could remember those stockings being stuffed with Confederate bills. and of course they were worth nothing. Some way, somehow, she managed to get enough money together that she was able to get that covered wagon to Kansas. And when she got there, she homesteaded 160 acres down by Elk City. Now, why she didn't stay up in the Kansas City area where Margaret was, I have never understood. But she did never like Margaret's husband. Nobody in the family liked him. And as time went by, he turned out to be a real rascal. Margaret had this baby. The baby's name was Molly Virginia. And that man's name was, I thought it was Strata, but no, that's, I just can't remember her father's name. But anyway, when Molly Virginia was born, her mother, Margaret, died. And so the father took over the job of raising Molly Virginia, and he bought a house where he thought he could establish a boarding house arrangement, and he found a young middle-aged woman. She had two daughters, and he married her, and the two of them together were going to run this boarding house. Well, the way it worked out was that the two daughters were just treated like queens, and of course Molly Virginia was the little Cinderella of the bunch. At least that's the family mythology. And Molly Virginia had to work so hard. As time went by, she matured, became a young woman, and a young man moved into town named Fred Stratton. He took his meals there, and he and Molly Virginia became friendly. And one day, the father of Molly Virginia saw her slip a letter into Fred Stratton's coat that was hanging up in the hall, in the foyer. And, oh, he had a fit. He went over and got the letter and read it. He could see that they were very much in love. And he also could see that she was pregnant, according to the letter. And so he immediately confronted Fred Stratton and said he'd kill him if he didn't marry Molly Virginia immediately. Of course, he loved Molly Virginia. He wanted to marry her. And so they were married. Well, Molly Virginia couldn't have been happier until this Fred Stratton said, "I'd like to take you to meet my mother." Oh, I've got to tell you too, Fred Stratton ran the bank in town and was doing rather well for himself too at the bank. And he wanted to take Molly Virginia to go meet his mother, but he said, "I couldn't take you to meet my mother in the condition you're in." And so it was a very clear message to her to get an abortion right away, because he didn't want his mother to know that they had had relations before marriage. So she did. She had the abortion, and I guess it really messed her up inside. She had one more child later on in their marriage, and that was Fred Stratton Jr., and the doctors told her she could never have any more children. Eventually, Fred Stratton and Molly Virginia moved out to California, and I think it was Glendale, California, where they were. And they had a very successful life out there, financially successful. Fred Stratton just made money everywhere. He invested money in real estate in California. It just price of real estate only went in one direction, up, and he made a lot of money on properties. Fred Stratton Jr. married a woman named Julia, and Molly Virginia built a little house in the backyard. It was ridiculous, really, but it looked like a dollhouse, and Fred and Julia lived there. As long as they were married, they lived in that dollhouse. Fred died of a heart attack before Molly Virginia died. And Fred Stratton, the daddy, he died first. And then when Fred Stratton Jr. was like 36, he died of a heart attack. And for quite a little while, Molly Virginia lived in the house, and Julia lived in the little dollhouse in the backyard. I thought that was ridiculous. I don't know what happened to Molly Virginia's property when she died. I suppose Julia got it all. I imagine Julia moved into the big house. Well, my parents left Hutchinson in 1941, in the spring of 1941. They lost their home. The mortgage was foreclosed by the bank, and my grandparents had died just 6 months previous to this time. Their farm was just sitting there. Mother said, well, let's go out to the farm. I don't hear you. What did you say? Well, the situation was the bank foreclosed on my parents' home. And what my parents should have done and could have done if they went to see a lawyer, they should have sold the house and paid the bank whatever, you know, profit there was to be made, although I think the house sold finally for something like $1,800. But they only owed just a few hundred dollars. Bill says they probably missed about 5 payments, and that sounds about right. But they didn't know they could sell it. Mother thought if the bank foreclosed, that meant that they would just take the house and there was nothing that you could do about it. So she did nothing but pack us all up and move us out to the farm. My father, of course, was very frail. His health was bad. He'd been in the army, and he had scarlet fever. And the scarlet fever had left him with a kidney condition called Bright's disease. And he wasn't supposed to practice dentistry anymore. Mother said, well, you might have a little office there in Elk City, and maybe you could clean teeth or pull people's teeth, whatever. You just couldn't do any of the... what he liked to do was that prosthetic dentistry stuff. And as long as he did that, that was very dangerous. I forget what the name of the acid was. Acetone. Acetone, I think, was what they said was so damaging to his kidneys. Does that sound right to you, Bill? So as long as he didn't use that, he'd be all right. Well, he was very enthusiastic about that idea, and so first thing he did was got a little office there in Elk City, and he paid practically nothing, $25 a month, I think, rent. Well, when I was talking to Marjorie today, I made the remark that both of our parents were a couple of incredible failures, and I'm so sorry that I said that, because that's just not true. Now, my father was put out when he was 11 years old to work to earn his own living and send money home if he could make any. And that poor little fella, you know, for somebody to be put out in the street when they're 11, what that must do to your ego, to your sense of self-esteem. My gosh, the fact that he dreamed of becoming a dentist and worked his way there, earned money to pay his tuition and get there to Kansas City and go through dental school, that's just a miracle that he was able to do that. And then he came back to Hutchinson, and Bill was so taken with my father. At the time he died, my father was writing up some dental, information records, procedure. I don't remember what it was, but he was writing it up to submit to a dental journal. And Bill thought that was the most wonderful thing, that 65-year-old man, he was almost 65, was trying to write up something like that when he had been told he had cancer and was going in to have an Well, Bill was impressed with Daddy's interest in his profession. Even in his frail state, he was still thinking about it. I will say this, I never knew of my dad to not want to go to work. He never dreaded going to work. Well, except that he, I think, hated it, that he didn't have more patience. That part he hated. But so far as not wanting to go to work because he didn't like the work, no, he always loved dentistry. In fact, I used to talk to him about it. Why don't you try to do something else to make more money? And he'd say, no, I really love dentistry. And he would always say, you know, you could make a lot of money at dentistry if, and there were all kinds of ifs, but whatever they were, he just didn't. You see, both my parents had, I think, some kind of social handicap, both of them. My father, I forgive him because I think he did as good as he could possibly do. He was marvelous. He was wonderful that he made his way in the world as well as he did. But I think my father didn't understand much about how to relate to people in order to make them want to come to him for dental work. Sorry. Well, Bill's sick of hearing about my father. But there was something wrong with Mother. I don't know what it was. I think she had some kind of a social handicap, too. I think she would have been very happy in Hutchinson and successful in Hutchinson if, for example, she'd been a lawyer, or she had had some job where she had had authority and could have exerted leadership politically. I think Mother was a natural-born leader, and I think that if she could have been a political leader, she would have done well. She was great at hopping up and giving political speeches. I never heard her give one, but I know that every time there was any kind of a political race, people called on her to get up and make speeches for them, and she did. But somehow, some way, Mother missed the mark. Some, I don't know how. She had two wonderful parents, but there was something wrong with Mother, and Daddy too. And I guess maybe it was the times they lived in. But Bill wants me to tell you about when I did the radio show. I was 13, and my mother went to Elk City. No, I wasn't 13. I was like 12. She went to Elk City to help my grandparents in the summertime. That's when the harvest came, and she always helped cook for the harvest men. So I went down to the radio station, KWBG, that was the name of the radio station. And I talked to Mendel, letting me do a little 15-minute show called Musical Moments. And I told him, I'll bring in a different musician every day. And one day we'll have a trumpeter, and one day we'll have clarinet, and one day I'll bring in all my friends from the band and from the orchestra, and we'll have different things, and I'll play the piano, I'll accompany them. And they said, well, that's great. That sounds good to us. You do that. So I did it. And I had a wonderful time. I just had to figure out one 15-minute show a week, and I did it for 8 weeks, and I had a ball, and that's all there was to that. That's all there was to it.
Did you give little lectures?
Oh, yes. Oh, I did, Candy. I always talked about the composer, and, you know, I gave a little talk about when it was written and how it came to be written, and I, you know, did a little research job on all the stuff that we did. And most of the stuff that we did was pretty good stuff, because I got kids who were going to major in music in college, you know, and I was the youngest of that bunch, so all of the kids were older that I got to come in, and they were all very serious musicians. Okay, well, that's it for me. Goodbye, so long.
Well, now, Candace has requested that we go back in my ancestry more. My grandfather was Walter Jefferson Howland, we call Daddy Pop. His father was Egbert Howland. Egbert Ferris, I believe. Anyway, Egbert. And I remember going to visit him, my great-grandfather, when I was just 3 years old. And he had there, we say, my folks went to go visit some of the other relatives and left me there for him to babysit. And we were sitting on his front porch, and he had there an ashtray with a tire around it, an advertisement for Firestone, I think. And I played with that, and I let it roll down the steps, down the yard, out into the street. And I remember how distressed I was about that. And I remember my great-grandfather laughed, and he thought it was very funny. And he got up and went and got it for me. And that's the only memory I have of my great-grandfather. Now, a little bit about my mother. My mother, oh, yeah. The other thing that they wanted us to talk about was the sod house. Egbert lived in Pearl, Illinois, with his children, and they got, as Daddy Pop described it, they got the Kansas fever, and they decided to go out to Kansas and make a fortune by staking a claim and farming. So they went out there in the summertime, and they built a sod house. I believe at that time he would have had about 6 children. I think he had 7 children altogether, but I think the youngest one was Aunt Maud, and she was the baby sister. Anyway, I can't remember Egbert's wife's name, and I think she died relatively young. But anyway, they went out there and they built a sod house, and they started farming. And then in the wintertime, the sod shrunk on the house, so the kids all had to sleep up in the loft. And Daddy Pop said they would wake up in the morning, and there would be snow all over their covers there. But they were under heavy covers, so, you know, they were all right, but it was just such a
second story separated from the first.
He said that the second story, or the loft part, separated from the bottom part of the sod house, and because it was so cold, and there was about a 6-inch space for the wind to blow through. You know, my Uncle Joe, who was 10 years older than my father, married Clara Day, and she told similar stories about their her family going out to Kansas and thinking they were going to make a fortune by staking a claim and farming. Well, this was before she was born. They were on their way out there, and I don't think it was a hurricane, but it was a big wind came up, and when it came up, her mother went into labor, and so they got out of the wagon, and she laid down in a ditch, and Aunt Clara said, "Nobody can beat that. I wasn't born in the hospital. I wasn't born at home. I was born in a ditch." Aunt Clara lived to be 105 years old, and we went to her 100th birthday, and she was still very sharp. She took college courses when she was 90. So an interesting person. Uncle Joe, and Aunt Clara too for that matter, loved to tell stories, but my mother and father always said, "Well, you know, they're about half true." But they were fascinating stories. And I'll tell you a story about Orange Howland.
That Uncle Joe told.
Well, one of the stories that Uncle Joe told, and told on several occasions, was about his grandfather, Orange Howland. Orange Howland was born in the early 1800s, maybe 1805, somewhere along there. His father was a wealthy shipbuilder, and Howland Island in the Pacific was named by one of his captains to honor Orange's father. And at any rate, Orange went to, you know, wonderful schools and had a life of privilege and wealth. But when he was about 20 years old, he fell in love with an Irish girl. Her father owned a bar, a pub, in Boston. And the Irish in those days were considered very low-class people. They were discriminated against terribly. So Orange's father was extremely upset that he had fallen in love with a Catholic girl, and they got secretly married in the Catholic Church. And this upset the father so much that he said, "I'm going to disinherit you, Orange, but I'm going to give you a ship, a new ship that they're just completing work on now." Well, here's where Uncle Joe's story buried sometimes. Sometimes that was an ocean-going vessel. Other times this was a ship that went on the river. At any rate, on its maiden voyage, when Orange and his wife were on board, the boiler blew up and the ship sank, and they had to swim to shore. But they were then penniless. They had thought they would have a good income from the ship, but then they were penniless and disinherited. So the girl, whose name I can't think of, an Irish name, Kathleen, we'll call her Kathleen. Kathleen said, "Well, my two brothers have gone to Texas and have a big ranch. We'll write to them and we'll go and stay with them." So they did. And several children were born there. And then Orange heard about the gold rush in California in 1949. So he, when that 49, yeah. So he and a friend of his started up for to go to the gold rush, and they teamed up with a group of men who were going there, and they got to the area of the Grand Canyon in Colorado, and one of the men, not Orange or his friend, raped an Indian woman, and the Indians, they knew the Indians would be coming after them, so they went down into the Grand Canyon, and then they were, the Indians were afraid to go into the Grand Canyon, so they couldn't get them, and then Orange and his friend were able to scale the other wall of the Grand Canyon, somewhere or another, and they got to California. By the time they staked out claims, but they didn't find any gold. So Orange said, "Okay, I'm going to sell my horse and what little we have accumulated, go back home." His friend stayed there and opened a store and became fabulously wealthy by selling supplies to the miners. But Orange went back home and back home to Texas to the ranch, and they stayed there and had several more children. And then the Civil War started. He said, "I can't be a Southerner. I can't fight against my country." So then they moved back to Pearl, Illinois, which is where his relative, he had some kind of relatives that lived in that area, and joined the Union Army. In the Union Army, he was in a number of battles and then was captured at Cold Harbor, wherever that is. Anyway, he was captured by the South and sent to Andersonville, the big Southern prison. And everybody, that was so overcrowded, so contaminated, everybody was dying. But some friends or people that he had known from the Illinois regiment said, "If you don't drink the water, if you only drink coffee made from chicory, you won't get sick." So that's what he did, and he didn't get sick, because when the water was boiled, it got rid of all the bacteria. Anyway, after a few months there, they sent out, "We need volunteers to go south and make coffins." Anybody that's had experience? And he had experience. He had worked for his father as a cabinet maker on the ships. So he'd had experience, and so he volunteered. And then on the trip south, the train came close to a river, and he managed to, he and a number of other Union prisoners managed to pry open the boxcar door and jumped out of the train. Several of them were severely hurt in that, but he wasn't, and he managed to get to the river and swim across it and work his way back to Illinois. But when he got back to Illinois, he said, "I don't want to go back in the Army anymore." And so he hid out in caves, and his wife would bring him food once a week. And so he lived out the rest of the war, the rest of the war in these caves. After that, he became a successful farmer in the Illinois. But after a while, his mother wrote to him, his father died, said, "I have a nice little house here in Boston that I'll just give you and your wife if you'll come back and be close." So they did. Uncle Joe, when he was a small boy, about 8 years old, went to visit them with his father in Boston. And he said that Orange was dressed in a beautiful white linen suit, sitting out under a tree, reading the paper, and his wife was in the house doing laundry for neighbors to make a little bit of money. It's sort of a sad story. Now, my mother had an unbelievable amount of courage and presence of mind. When I was about 7 years old, my cousin John and my cousin Lois and I decided we'd go swimming. We were having a picnic at a little stream in Missouri. So we went out swimming. The current caught us and swept us downstream to where it was way over our heads, very deep. And we were drowning. None of us could swim worth a darn. My mother saw that was happening.